tonight's speaker. Please offer a Warren Valley Group welcome to Jerry D. from Fresno.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jerry D. I'm a human being who's an alcoholic. And it's, I want to thank Bill and the group for asking me to come down from Fresno to come to this meeting. I know a couple people here from Fresno, and it's nice to be in your home. And it's nice to feel welcome and know that I am among men and women who share common trauma that I have. When the basket comes around, I have something for it. So I'll put that there. My sobriety date is November the 4th, 1983. I have a sponsor, Mike D. My home group is Rule 62, Men's Stag, Thursday night, don't take yourself too damn seriously. I've worked the steps with my sponsor. He's worked the steps with his sponsor. I have a sponsee in this room. I have former sponsees in this room, and I have grand sponsees in this room. And we meet regularly. And hopefully, when I think about it, it's all about being a part of that unbroken chain of one alcoholic talking with and working with another alcoholic that we can trace back. If we had the time and the willingness and care about it, probably take it all the way back to Bill W. and Dr. Bob. So I'm blessed to be another part of this. I made notes. This is the theme of my talk tonight. Me too. And here I am again. Here are my notes. What it was like, 10 minutes or so. What happened, 10 minutes or so. What it's like now, 20 minutes or so. Now, I'm a retired professor, and I'm pretty good at the 45-minute hour. But I have some of the men that I know and do things in recovery that if I get going on and on, they're going to be over there doing this. So I'll watch myself. I like to change the way I feel. I grew up in a middle-class family. My father was in the Air Force, which means we moved around an awful lot when I was growing up. About every 2 years, we would move to another neighborhood. And I'm a middle child. My father was an officer. So sometimes we lived on base, the Air Force base, and sometimes we lived off the base. But one of the interesting things that happened was, early on, being a middle child, and what I've learned through the steps and through my inventories and through working with the sponsor and through prayer and meditation, that I'm a pretty self-centered guy, and I want to be liked, and I want to belong, and I want to fit in. So I've learned that about myself. And so what happened to me as I was growing up was every 2 years, just when I would get close with and familiar with friends and a community, we had to move. And so I went from living in California to Ohio, and then I went to New Jersey, you know, and I found out that the guys in New Jersey talk a certain way, so I wanted to fit in. And then we moved to Alabama, and so I found out that I've put some South in my mouth that y'all might like me a little better. And then we went, and so, you know, what happened with me is, and that's one of the first things of my themes, that whenever I moved to a new area and you said you liked fill in the blank, you know what my response was? Me too. Me too. And so if you like this music, well, me too. If you like to dress this way, well, me too. If you wanted to have certain food, well, me too. If you wanted to cut school and I wanted you to like me, me too. And so what I found out early on was that I like to change the way I feel, and with certain of the people that I ran with, the ones who were willing to meet new people and somebody who would be willing to be a follower, of which I was. I was a follower. I was not a leader as a young man, as a child. That I engaged in such behaviors as cutting school, and that was kind of exciting, or petty theft. That was exciting. And I found out that adrenaline was the first thing that I learned how to use to change the way I feel. Because I started to play a game, and maybe some of you have played this game as a child or as an adult. The name of the game is Cops and Robbers. You know. And I was always a robber. And the cops were sworn personnel, or my mother, or my father, or the teacher. And I got a question, a rhetorical question, if you will. How many robbers tell cops the truth? No. We lie. And when you lie, unless you're a sociopath, you feel guilt. And guilt is, if you think of pleasurable or a painful feeling, it's a painful feeling. And I've learned how to change the way I feel. And so that cycle began with me early on. I had an older brother who had since passed, and he used to smoke cigarettes, so I wanted to smoke cigarettes to be like my big brother. It was another way of changing the way I felt, and so I changed adrenaline for nicotine. And that was something that I learned I could change the way I felt on demand. And then, in high school, I discovered alcohol. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was in... I graduated from high school in 1965, and so in the early 1960s, what I drank, I don't know about you, first time you drank, did you ever just say, I'll just have a glass of wine? I drank to drunkenness. That's what I did. And I found that that was one more thing I could do in my life to blow my mind on demand, that I could change the way I felt. And all of those feelings of not fitting in, and, you know, the false core belief that many of us have, which is basically, I'm not good enough. That's a common, I think, core false belief that people have, is that I'm not worth it, I'm not worth this, I'm not good enough. And those feelings went away. And so I didn't become a daily drinker right away, but every time I had the opportunity to consume alcohol, I did it to drunkenness. And so it was another way to play cops and robbers. Now, I'm a child of the 60s. I graduated in 65. Guess what else was going on in Southern California and San Francisco in 65? Peace, love, dove. You know, I was right up there with everybody else. And I don't want to go into a long drunk and drug-a-log, but I'll just say that from when I first started changing the way I felt with chemicals in the 60s in high school, I found that I finally developed a disease of alcoholism. And you know, alcoholism is physical addiction to C2H5OH, ethyl alcohol. That's what it is. And I don't care who you are, if you drink enough C2H5OH, often enough, and in enough quantity, you will develop a cellular dependence. You will be alcoholic. And once that change happens, you know, you all have probably heard the story of the cucumber and the pickle, right? Once you were a pickle, or a cucumber, and then you put alcohol in your system, and you became a pickle, and a pickle can never be a cucumber again. And, you know, I am a pickle. I developed alcoholism. And you know, we heard it in chapter 3, more about alcoholism was read. Try some controlled drinking. See what happens. And I found that when I would start drinking, I could not stop. And so I would drink till the money was gone or the bar closed, then I'd go someplace else or I'd pass out. But the other thing that I found out early on is that when I did drink, or if I would say, I'm not going to drink tonight, or I won't drink for a week. How many of you have done that? I won't drink for 7 days. And after the fourth day, you said, because this is what I did, hey, I went 4 days. If I was alcoholic, I couldn't be able to go 4 days. So I'm not alcoholic. You see, I'm a really smart guy. I have a lot of letters after my name. I have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a doctoral degree, but I'll tell you more about that a little later. But I'm a real smart guy, so I was always able to justify and talk myself out of why I wasn't alcoholic. I began to combine other substances at will and frequently on a daily basis, but I always drank, and I will limit my comments today really to alcohol. I played cops and robbers for a lot of years, and from 1965 up to 1970, I changed the way I felt on a daily basis. I wasn't able to work. I went to college in 65. I flunked out of college. I had a 1.2 grade point average. I majored in campus center, fraternity, Red Mountain Wine, beach volleyball, and bridge. And I flunked out of college. And so in order to support myself, I played cops and robbers some more. Well, my experience has been that when I play cops and robbers, the cops always win. Because I do stupid things when I'm under the influence of alcohol. Most commonly, I drive an automobile or a motorcycle. And I ride Harleys. I got my Harley shirt on tonight. And I've been arrested 7 times. I beat a lot of those beats because I'm a smart guy. I know how to do it. What happened to me was in 1970, I got caught drunk, loaded with a half a ton of pot, and I went to the federal penitentiary for a year and a half. I made a decision when I was in prison. I said, you know what? If I didn't drink or do those other things, I probably wouldn't be here. So I made a conscious decision while in the penitentiary not to consume any Applejack, Pruno, Raisinate, or anything else that was available to me on demand in the penitentiary. I got out in 1972. My father said, welcome home. I got admitted to Long Beach State College. I got a job in a drug and alcohol clinic as a paraprofessional counselor. And my father said, son, would you like a beer? I said, absolutely. Because I'm alcoholic. And you know the rest of that story. For the next, from 1972 until 1983, I drank on a daily basis. And I did other things. I am one of those high bottom drunks that we read about in the Big Book. If you're familiar with the Big Book in our literature, if you've read AA Comes of Age or The Language of the Heart or any of our other literature on the history of AA, you'll know that the first so many years in the hundreds and thousands were really the low bottom asylum hospitalized individuals. And then in the 40s and 50s, individuals like myself and maybe you came in that didn't end up in the gutter, that didn't end up in an asylum, that maybe went to a rehab, that maybe got the word, or maybe you just woke up and said, screw this crap, I'm not going to drink anymore and I need help. That was me. I never lost a job because of drinking, but I went to jail a lot. But I didn't lose a job. And I was never homeless or had another thing. So that's not a part of my story. What happened to me was that after I got paroled, I went to work, I got a degree, I did well, I got married, I got cars, I got homes, all that stuff, got motorcycles, but I was still drinking on a daily basis. I got a DUI because I crashed my motorcycle, split my head open, almost killed my second wife, and it scared me so bad I quit drinking for 7 days. Because I'm alcoholic, and I told myself that, you fill in the blank. What did you tell yourself all those times when you said, I'm going to quit this time? And I was put on probation. And, of course, I'm an alcoholic. So I kept drinking. And 6 months later, I got caught again, driving under the influence, stone drunk. I was so drunk that when they pulled me over, I put my wrist out the window when he said license and registration, because I knew that I wouldn't be able to stand and do the field sobriety test. So I went before the judge, and he gave me 30 days in jail, work furlough. And I felt really pretty lucky. And so I go to do my time to go to the jail. And I'm getting processed, and the sheriffs are there taking all my stuff. Now, I've been through this routine before. You go in the room, some of you may know this, you go in the room, the man's behind the bar of the cage, there's a line on the floor, you put your toes on the line, you put your ass on the wall, and you sit there and you don't say anything, and you assume the position. And you let everybody else know, don't freak with me. And it all came over me, because people would ask me, oh my gosh, Jerry, you're going to have to go to jail for 30 days. You know what my response was?
Shit.
With all the time I've done, I can do 30 days sitting on the shitter. Ain't no thing. And I'm sitting there in jail. And it all comes over me. Here I am again. Dope fiend, alcoholic, ex-con. Here I am again. Didn't matter all those other things that had happened to me. Didn't matter all those possessions. Didn't matter all that stuff external. Inside, I was morally, spiritually, everything. I was bankrupt and broken. And that was my bottom. And it was after that, almost 30 years ago, that I got down on my knees, because I was required to come to these classes, these A&A classes, you know. You got a big class here. And the old timer said, Jerry, sometimes you just have to sit there and hurt. I didn't want to hear that. You just have to put the plug in the jug. I didn't want to hear that. And they said, all you need to do is to ask the God of your understanding to relieve you of the obsession to drink. And I didn't believe that. But I did. I traveled the greatest distance I've ever traveled, which was from a standing to a kneeling position. I was by myself in my living room. I was crying. I felt lost. And I said, God, remove from me the obsession to drink. And my knees got sore and I felt embarrassed. And I got up and I haven't had a drink since. I'm not like Bill W.'s story, my bites and everything else. I'm more like Bill or some of the, Bob or some of the others, that it just kind of happened. And I started coming to these rooms, and I started listening to all of you, and I said, after I said these three words, God help me, I said these three words, I need help. And I offered myself to the group, and I got sober in men's meetings, and men's meetings have been an active part of my recovery for all these years. It just works best for me, because I'm distracted by in co-ed meetings because I want to look good, and I still have those parts of it, and I don't get as real for me unless when I'm in a men's meeting we can just have it down. And I've heard women that are good friends of mine in recovery tell me that's why we go to women's meetings. So you know, we go where we need to go to get what we need to get. I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. I moved across the United States and I entered a doctoral program. And my life today is a direct result of, and it's a gift of recovery. Because I was able to go back to school and have a new life and do everything that it took for me to become a teacher. And a teacher of men and women. And I just retired from Fresno State. And it's all a gift of recovery. That I learned, and you told me that I could do anything I wanted to do as long as I put my recovery first and as long as I kept seeking that spiritual transformation. Now, that's something that I didn't want to hear. And if some of you are new and you're here because of a court card, I don't know any of you. Well, I know some of you here, but I don't know any of you here. I don't know if you're alcoholic or not. I don't know. You may not be alcoholic. You may have just been that unlucky guy or gal who the cops were picking on me. They were hanging right out there at Main and Court. And, you know, they were waiting and it was just bad luck. But if you're alcoholic like I am, what I know is this, and this is just my experience, that it's a spiritual solution. It's a spiritual transformation. For the God of, as you understand. So, you know, that's what happened with me. And I got into service. And I rode in a clean and sober motorcycle club, Harley Club, for 10 years on the East Coast. And we rode the meetings and we rode the national conventions and we carried the message to a different kind of a community. And you know, I still ride today and I still ride with a bunch of sober guys and we still do a lot of things. What I've discovered is that the only thing I cannot do today that I did when I drank and drugged is drink and drug. That's the only thing I can't do today. Everything else I'm able to do, and I'm better at it. In reality, I'm better at it. Not just, oh, I'm better at it. Remember, you always used to say, I can dance better when I'm drunk. No, you can't. No, we got you on video. No, you can't really at all. But you know, I can do all those things today, and I can experience them, and I can remember. But you know, I'm not the poster child for Alcoholics Anonymous. My first 7 years when I was in Massachusetts, I lived back in Massachusetts for 14 winters. I came back to California 15 years ago, and my first sponsor died. And I ended up going about 12, 13 years without a sponsor. But, see, I'm a smart guy. See, I got all these education letters after me. I know about stuff. I teach courses in alcohol and alcoholism at the university, don't you know? I got all this. And so I didn't have a sponsor, and I kept going to meetings. And I had positive relationships with other men, but I did not have that one most important relationship, to have that accountability relationship with another man that I was going to say everything to. Because when I was hanging with the brothers, you see, for me, the decision has already been made. I ain't picking up no matter what. I am a member of the No Matter What Club. I don't know about you, but I am. No matter what, I ain't picking up. But I also got into the habit of the stuff that was really going on, I'll handle it myself. And so what happened was, I stayed. I didn't pick up, but I went an awful long time not hooked up with the program. And you know what happens then? I got very busy. Once I finished my doctorate, I stopped riding in the motorcycle club, and the guy said, "What's up, Doc?" That's my nickname, is Doc. And I said, "Well, I came here to get a doctorate, and I have it. Now I want to do doctor things." And I started doing other stuff, and I got off in a career, and you've seen it around these rooms. People get 3, 5, 7 years, their life comes back, we don't see them anymore. And it's not that they're out there using, but we recover. That's what recovery means. We recover. We regain those aspects of our lives that add value to our lives. We care for our families. We make financial amends. We have plans. We have children. We start caring. We get involved in community activities. We get involved perhaps in a church or a spiritual community or hobbies or whatever. And we think, I remember those days. I know where a meeting is, and that was my line. I know where a meeting is if I need one. And then what happened was, once I moved to California, I didn't go to meetings for a lot of years. Because I'm a doctor now. I need to get tenure. I need to do all these things. Don't you know who I am? And I became very ego-driven, and all of those character defects that kept me out there all came back in spades. Self-centeredness, egoism, not wanting to admit that I don't know, not wanting to admit that I have some fears, not wanting to admit that I'm not sure about this or that, and not getting filled with the fellowship of the Spirit. And the spirit of the fellowship. Instead, I sought other ways to change the way I feel. Now, I'm a behaviorist. I know about what people do to blow their mind on demand. And I told you what some of my first ones were, and you can relate. Adrenaline, tobacco, caffeine. I have my coffee. But I also know alcohol, but I also know that sex is another thing we do to blow our mind on demand. I know that food is something that we do to blow our mind on demand. When you're upset at night, you go home, little chunky monkey at night by yourself, and you get that feeling from that exercise. Other things like gambling. There are other things we do to blow our minds on demand that take the place of what I found to be that strength that comes from pursuing that spiritual transformation. And so what happened was, I was in my second marriage. That marriage failed. Now, I gotta tell you, I was given a lecture at the university, and it was in my alcoholism class, and I'm talking about codependency and enabling behaviors. And I'm writing on the board, like you were the class. I'm out here writing, and they're watching what I'm writing, and I'm writing up the major components of codependency. And it all comes over me again. Here I am again. You know, I'm 17 years sober, and I'm nothing but an alcoholic, ex-con, go fiend, and here I am again with all these character defects. And I felt all the blood drain from my head and my body, and I felt like my knees were going to buckle because I had another one of those awakenings. Another bottom was that I am all screwed up. And what I wanted to do was to put down that chalk and walk out of the classroom, but I didn't. I finished the lecture, and guess what the first thing I did was? I went to a meeting. I'm Jerry D. I have 17 years, and I'm all screwed up. I need help. And I put myself in therapy because if you got a Cadillac, and you got some Cadillac problems, sometimes you don't go to a Volkswagen mechanic to fix them. You go to somebody who can really help. And I put myself in therapy. I got a sponsor. You got it from here. I worked the steps. I got in service. I got honest. I got out of the marriage that I was holding her hostage in. That changed, you know, that I was holding myself hostage. I was holding on to things with bloody knuckles. So again, I'm not that poster child of AA that says, oh, everything was all fine. I've had my experiences in life, because life's what happens to you while you make other friends, right? Woody Allen said that in one of his movies, and it's great sage advice. And that I wasn't using the tools that allowed me to have the successes in life that I enjoy today. Now, it's been 13 years since I have gotten reconnected within the fellowship within Fresno. There's great recovery in Fresno. There's great opportunities. There's good meetings. And I have availed myself of all of those activities. One of the things that I have not missed at all in these past 13 years is to revisit some of the behaviors that were suggested to me early on. And that is, every morning when I get up, after taking care of some personal hygiene and taking a little caffeine, I go into a room and I get some of our literature. It depends. I read different books at different times of the year, and I'll spend at least 10 to 30 minutes reading. I spend time in meditation and just reflecting on what I read. I would go from a seating to a kneeling position, and I ask the God of my understanding to bless, and I pray out loud, because it's like writing when your sponsor tells you to write. When you do that, you take a stand. You uncover it. It's all available for all to see. So I pray out loud. I ask God's grace on my wife, on my sisters, on my family. I name all of my sponsees. I name my sponsor. If people are dealing with cancer or other issues, I name them. I have a long prayer list. I ask to be impeccable with my word, to not take things personally, to not make assumptions in life, and to just do my best. And then I get up and I go on my day. I do that. It's that discipline. You know, an old timer who passed recently once told me, I heard in the meeting, he said, you know, recovery is a discipline, and I like that. And my sponsees know that what I tell them is my recovery is purposeful and it's deliberate. Purposeful and deliberate. Because I'm an alcoholic. I've learned that any time over all those years, if I stray away from, for me, this is just Jerry D's experience, that when I stray away from the discipline and a spiritual task, I get all screwed up. I get full of me, and I do things that don't add value to my life. And that's basically it. So I talk to the men that I sponsor. We have conversations. What adds value to your life? I think those are important questions. And not what thing, but what attributes. Well, I like a lot of friends. Say more. What is it about friends? What is it about it? Is it the intimacy? What does that look like? And it's all about articulating and naming what those things are. Because once we name them, then we'll know what to look for. And I can be upfront with people. There is no friend I have today that I got by not doing this. This is how I develop friendships. What's your name? Tim. I would say, Tim, it's been nice seeing you in a meeting. You know what? I would like to spend more time with you to get to know you and maybe develop a friendship. To me, that's purposeful and deliberate. I'm upfront about what it is, and you can make a decision about whether or not you have time or you want to do that. And it's like when men ask me, will you sponsor me? I always tell them no right away. Why? Because I don't know them. They don't know me. What I'll say is, we'll see. You want to have coffee? Or call me. It's purposeful and deliberate. And then we can have a conversation. It may be just that you said a bunch of funny things that day and it resonated with me, and yet we don't have really that much in common. But we won't know unless we do what? We spend time. And the other thing that I've learned about my recovery and working with others and in the fellowship is the greatest gift that I can give is the gift of time. All the other stuff doesn't really matter. But to sit down, to come to a meeting, to come down, to take time and to offer my experience, strength, and hope, to sit down with people afterwards. I think you all do that a lot, right? Many people, you go out, you do something afterwards, you give of yourself. That is the greatest gift I think we can give to the new people who come in here. I believe that they come in unsure, scared, wondering what the hell's going on. What is this all about? You know, the reason we all hold hands at the end is to freak out the newcomers. That's one of the things that happens. And they wonder what's going on here. Oh no, they're going to say a prayer. Oh no. But you know, we give of ourselves. Today, I still am involved with Me Too, and here I am again. When people talk about, you know, I want to improve my conscious contact with the God of my understanding. Me too. I want to stay engaged in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Me too. I want to develop friendships, meaningful friendships, that when things go tough for me, now I know I can make a call to almost anybody in my phone list and they'll be there, and I'll be there for them. Me too. And today, when it comes to being in a meeting, I can say, there I am again. You know, when I go to my men's stag meeting on Saturday morning to see our fellowship, here I am again. I have a book study at my house on Tuesday night with the men I sponsor. Here we are again. That we do the same things, purposeful and deliberate. One of the things that, as I begin to wind down, that I think is important, and it's one of the things that helped me in my recovery, is to understand that you can't talk your way out of something you behaved your way into. You can't talk your way out of something that you behaved your way into. I don't know about you, but I behave my way into this podium. I behave my way into those, well, dear, plastic chairs here. Some of them are metal. I behave my way into prison. I behave my way into jail. I behave my way flunking out of school. I behave my way into the room. And I got better by acting and doing different things. It's a program of action, right? We have a whole chapter in our book, How It Works, and then into action. And that whole chapter that Bill wrote that he struggled over about saying, this is how we do it, and all the examples that are there, we behave our way into recovery. We can talk and share with other people that are new what our experience was. As I get a chance to do that tonight, that I've had a chance to come up here and share with you, this has been my experience in recovery. You know, I didn't always look as good as I do now. You know, I've got a great smile. but it's because I got the best smile money can buy. Because when I was drinking, I busted out all of my teeth in car accidents. Because every time I get in a car wreck, I would go, ah, the steering wheel would go right in my mouth and bust out all my teeth. So I got a great smile. But if you see me in the morning, I don't look like this. I wear glasses now because I'm 65 years old and I can't hear all of blur now. I have two artificial hips because I drank and fell down a lot on my hips. I developed osteoarthritis. I've had two major surgeries. I have two artificial hips. Today, I played a round of golf. This past week, I rode 60 miles on my road bike, which is, since I can't run anymore, I ride my bicycle for my heart, I ride the Harley for my soul. There's not anything I can do today that I, you know, I can't do today that I did when I was drinking, except drinking drugs. So, you know, but I found a way through the fellowship and through recovery to walk through all these traumas. I thought I was going to be crippled for life. After my first hip got replaced and I was rocking and rolling, I put in a Christmas tree light. I live on a historic street in Fresno where we're all required to put up lights. I fell 12 feet from a ladder on a cement driveway on my hip. And I laid on the ground and I said I had just shattered my hip. I had nothing but this image of a jigsaw puzzle in my whole pelvic girdle. And I thought, I'm laying on the ground, I'm crippled for life. I go to the emergency room, the doctor comes back in, he says, well, no breaks, no dislocations. You know, then I had a second hip replaced. And I talked about the fellowship, I'm going to be on some pain medication because it hurts. But you know, I walked through it with the fellowship. You know, my wife, the lovely Louise, this is what I'm prescribed. As soon as I can, I'm not taking them. And that's what I did. I worked through it in recovery with everybody so that I didn't have any secrets, nothing to hide. And we live life on life terms. So, you know, I've had all those opportunities. And I want to thank you all for, and thank you for wherever you go. Oh, Bill's over here. Thanks, Bill. Bill met me, I did a panel on the doctor's opinion at the ACCUPAW conference in Fresno, and he came up afterwards and asked me if I'd be willing to come down here, and I said I would. I've been looking forward to this, and I will say this in closing. Speaking to you tonight has added value to my life, and so thank you for the opportunity. Yeah.